Since the Russian-Western tension began over Ukraine, the term called soft power became very popular. Russia accuses West and West accuses Russia in using soft power to advance their agendas, including in Central Asia. Since then, new media projects are being established. Russia's Sputnik is one of the recent examples, which continues to expand, promoting aggressively the Kremlin line of thinking. Their move has never been as aggressive as today. So in this panel, we aim to discuss its implications in Central Asia, how effective the Russian move has been, what is being done to counter this move, and what are the best strategies to do so. To discuss the subject, I have parliamentarian Roshan Jeenbekov, who is from Kyrgyzstan. Kyrgyzstan is one of the most vulnerable countries when it comes to Russian move. From New York, Casey Michel, a journalist who has just written a story in our subject, is with us. In the studio, joining me, Bruce Panier, who is the editor of Central Asia blog called Kishlak Awazi at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, and Bradley Jardin, who is Central Asia researcher at Glasgow University. I am Mohammed Tahir, director of Turkmenistan service at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. Welcome, gentlemen, to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Casey, can you define us the soft power? What does it include in its current shape? We understand it mainly as a media tool.
Well, soft power is one of those nice amorphous terms that many different individuals, many different organizations, many different theorists can place their own terms, terminology, viewpoints within soft power. So it can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people. In this context, as it pertains to Russian soft power in Central Asia, it's a bit different than what has been traditionally understood as soft power. Now, when soft power was originally formulated 2 decades ago, it was as a means of attraction, and it's applied specifically to the Western attraction to developing nations, and that is in economic policy or social policy or what have you. As it pertains to the recent upsurge in Russian, what we can call soft power in Central Asia, that's not necessarily attraction, though that is still there, both economically and culturally, but it's something a little bit different. It's something a little bit more forward. It's something a little bit more, if you'd like to use the term, aggressive. And I know, Mohammed, you just mentioned one instance of this in media as it pertains to the growth of Sputnik in the region. And I think Sputnik is a great example, and I'm happy you highlighted it, because what we've seen happen with Sputnik in especially Kyrgyzstan and especially Tajikistan is the usage of local journalists, very talented journalists, very qualified journalists, who have gone over to Sputnik recently. And Sputnik, as I'm sure everyone is aware, and all the listeners are aware, ties a very pro-Kremlin line. And the Kremlin and Russia has been able to recruit these journalists to come work at Sputnik. So instead of working at whichever local newspaper or outlet in Kyrgyzstan or Tajikistan these journalists were working at before, they are now working for a pro-Kremlin, Kremlin-funded outlet. And this is, again, one of the kind of prime examples of soft power for Russia in Central Asia. And I would love to hear everyone else's thoughts on other extensions of soft power in this regard.
Right. When we look at the one leg of this, which is a media, as Casey, you just mentioned, so what Russia has been doing lately to advance its agenda using the media in Central Asia, Bradley?
In Kazakhstan, I mean, Russia uses a lot of its social networks to promote its agenda as well as spread its cultural influence. I mean, in Kazakhstan, for instance, Moimir is the most popular social networking site. They also have VKontakte and another one called Odnoklassniki, which is a way of keeping in contact with old class members. Yeah. So these are all really popular outlets in Kazakhstan. Mm. Another one is just the presence of Russian media in general. I mean, most cable TV packages in Kazakhstan offer the Russian channels, like all of them. You know, even activists in Kazakhstan refer to it as a zombie box, and that it's promoting towing the Kremlin line and just promoting propaganda, basically. But the youth are increasingly using these media sites, particularly Mail.ru, which is the most popular, and this includes the social networking sites like Moimir.
Right. Bruce, we also know that Russian news organization called Sputnik was expanding its operation in Tajikistan lately. What else can be added into this Russia's advance in Central Asia with its soft power tools, especially the media?
Of course, I'm dealing more with the regular Russian media that I've been dealing with for years, the state news agencies, some of the other outlets, main TV channels and stuff. And one of the things I was struck with, especially recently, because we had the 70-year anniversary at the end of World War II, was how much more prominence they gave to the Central Asian role. You know, now none of the Central Asian states want to be part of the Soviet Union again, but I thought it was very interesting that that was a way of bringing the Central Asians closer to Moscow, because they were stressing this common history that they had. And it was, you know, and I've been watching these anniversaries come for many, many years, and I don't ever remember seeing that much space or that much time being given to the contributions of the people of Tajikistan, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan, and Turkmenistan during World War II. They really played that up. And even at the May 9th celebrations, you know, they made a big deal out of bringing veterans from Central Asia to Moscow and filming them being there and speaking about their experience during World War II and everything. So they gave them a much more prominent role. And you could see that the whole tactic behind this was to remind the Central Asians of the common history that they'd had with Russia, and that, you know, Russia had should be viewed anyway as an old friend rather than, you know, the colonial master or something like that. So it was clever, I suppose you could say, the way that they used that one event. I mean, there's lots of other examples, but this is just a very recent example of them using one event to promote the commonality of the history and the peoples all behind one at one point in history, all driven toward the same goal.
Right. Let's go to Kyrgyzstan. Roshan Ajinbekov, what Russia is doing in Kyrgyzstan in terms of advancing its goals in Kyrgyzstan using the soft power that we are talking about? And how different is it compared to the last several years? You know, the Kyrgyzstan or some of the other Central Asian countries have always been like under the influence of Russian media. How different is this today?
Traditionally, historically, Russia had a very big impact and a very big influence to Central Asia, especially to Kyrgyzstan. We have a long way in our history when many Kyrgyz people or Kyrgyz politicians, they studied from Moscow, from Russia. They got a big culture from this country. But nowadays, Russia don't use soft power in Kyrgyzstan. They was trying maybe last 2 years to do something with soft power, especially in education and culture, but they couldn't do it. Very easy for Russia to work in Kyrgyzstan just using their usual tools like propaganda, like energy, as in pressure or as in threat for Kyrgyzstan. And the second one is Russian government works in Kyrgyzstan just bribing Kyrgyz politicians, the Kyrgyz political parties and Kyrgyz government. And instead of moving soft power to work with such kind of tools, it's very effective and very easy for Russian government. Therefore, they just use propaganda, bribing, and energy as in pressure or as in the tool of solving their problems in Kyrgyzstan.
But wouldn't it be fair, this is Bruce, wouldn't it be fair to say that we had a great example of Russian soft power the last days of Bakiyev, because, of course, there was the loan that Russia gave. Bakiyev's son Maxim had used that for his own personal gain at the time. And at the time, Russian media just unloaded a lot of black propaganda, PR on the Kyrgyz government and Bakiyev specifically, which in to a large extent fomented the revolution that eventually ousted President Bakiyev.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. When since 2005 to 2008, when Bakiyev was enough effective for Russia, they supported Bakiyev. When Bakiyev wanted to change his mind about American military base in Kyrgyzstan, they just used their propaganda. And all Russian mass media, which are in Kyrgyz mass media sphere, they used against Bakiev, like Oyert, Airfare, NTV, Russia 24, and every Russian television channels, radio or newspapers, they worked against Bakiev and they did their job.
Casey, what's your reading of Russia's using the soft power in Central Asia? What are the popular tools there?
Well, I think one of the main things that we have to keep in mind or examine kind of in the context of soft power and Russia's recent soft power is the reason why. And one of the biggest reasons is the construct that we've seen within the third term of the Russki Mir, the Russian world, which he has painted as a civilizational struggle, a civilizational reality based around Moscow, with post-Soviet legacy for Russian speakers. And Central Asia plays a very key, if not the key, role, especially now that Ukraine has undergone its Euromaidan. Central Asia remains one of the last primary bastions of friendliness and amity toward Moscow. So it is creating a, as Putin has said, a civilizational reality in the region, and that's one of the things that this soft power is being used for. And whether it's the media, whether it is political contact, what have you, whatever aspect of soft power from Russia and Central Asia you want to see right now. And it is worth noting that it has had some effect. And I was looking at a poll just the other day, and I know polling in Central Asia is a beast in and of itself, but this was a Gallup poll examining, it was anti-American, anti-Western attitudes worldwide, and the country that saw the largest drop-off in terms of views on the West, and especially in America, in the entire world, was Kazakhstan. Which, as Bradley rightly pointed, has its own experiences and continues to experience with Russian media and Russian relations, which I think, and Tajikistan was also in the top five, and so I think that helps highlight some of the efficacy of the recent soft power approach from Moscow.
Rushen Yermakov, how effective Russia becoming using all these tools that it has in its arsenal in Central Asia in changing the minds and hearts of people?
By my observation, last 2 years, I was observing that Russia wants to repeat Western or American experience on using soft power in Central Asia, especially in Kyrgyzstan. They wanted to make some projects regarding culture, regarding mass media, regarding education. But I know that they couldn't reach their goal, and they failed. Therefore, I can say that they couldn't repeat Western way in Kyrgyzstan, and they couldn't use soft power in Central Asia. I can say about whole Central Asia, and I know that they, in Kyrgyzstan they couldn't use soft power.
Can you give some details of that, how Russia failed and what it was trying to do and how it was failed? I'm just trying to understand the circumstances in which you say that.
Yes, for example, Russian embassy or Russian Russki Mir or Rossotrudnichstvo, Russian cooperation organization like USAID or JICA, they was beginning some projects, but later we have heard that they had a problem with financing. And they had a problem with corruption in Kyrgyzstan, and they stopped all their programs in Kyrgyzstan now. Now, Rossotrudnichstvo or other some Russian projects, they work, but they work just on mass media. They opened internet websites. They're financing a little bit mass media in Kyrgyz language, and that's all.
It seems to me, Bruce, the counter strategy was kind of natural in Kyrgyzstan, what Russia was trying to do. How the Russian move is countered in rest of Central Asia, for example, in Tajikistan or in Kazakhstan or in Uzbekistan in that case?
Well, I mean, it's kind of tough in all those countries just because there is the availability of Russian programming in there. Certainly in the last nearly 25 years, every one of the countries has tried to do what it can to develop its own state media, for sure, yeah. Television and radio, and they're hoping that the people are willing to get their information from those, from their local sources. Of course, I don't think there's any of those countries where people believe everything that they hear from their own state media. There's no doubt about it. But, you know, so that still leaves Russia with the edge because, you know, I don't have to tell you, even in Turkmenistan, people that got their satellite dishes, which are supposed to be tearing down, you know, they'll still tune into Russian programming because they understand the language. And generally speaking, local programming in any of the five countries of Central Asia is besides the news, it's more focused on culture. So you end up with these two-hour music or dance programs or something like that, which aren't very interesting compared to Russian television or Russian radio, which appears and sounds much more dynamic than the local programming. You know, and to go with social media, to touch on what Bradley mentioned too, there have been attempts, certainly in Uzbekistan, I'll single out as one, to develop their own local social network system, which is, of course, heavily monitored by the government. There's no doubt about it, and they even admit it right up front. But they don't want people to go to Odnoklassniki and Vkontakte or even on Facebook. They're trying to develop their own domestic system that they would prefer that people logged on to when they actually got on. So, I mean, there's been efforts at the local levels, you know, among all the governments to try to develop some of their own media system, their own social network system. It hasn't, just because Russia has more money and some more experience, they're still far ahead of them for the most part. And I suppose I could follow up by mentioning that even non-Russian outside information sources have also had a hard time. We're one of them, for instance. But you know, China, Iran, there's a number of other countries, Turkey, that try to have some media penetration into Central Asia, and it's only been mixed results for the most part. It hasn't risen to the level of what Russia's media penetration is in the region, or what their ability to project their messages in the region. And Turkey is a great example, for instance. They do broadcast news and stuff, but what's the most popular programming from Turkey in Central Asia? And I'm including Tajikistan here. It's the soap operas.
Yeah.
You know, so that's the kind of stuff that people would rather watch. They don't really trust news from outside sources. They don't entirely trust Russian news, but they do more than they do. They trust Russian news more than they do the other people, China, America, Turkey, or Iran.
Casey, so it means, is Russia winning this war, if we call it a battle?
Well, that's a great question, Mohammed, and maybe that's the key question. I was just going to say, before I address that, I just want to go back to something Ruth said, because I think you made a fantastic point that is again, worth highlighting. And that, yes, there are local offerings, there are local news productions and local television shows within Central Asian states, and that those have existed for the last 25 years. But the production value and the production quality and the entertainment value of the Russian offering is beyond compare. And that's not only limited to Central Asia, but what Russia has been able to broadcast to the West with RT and with Sputnik. The production values of this and the pure watchability, I suppose, for lack of a better word, is up there with anything that you'll find on television. It's riveting. It holds your attention. And maybe if you're not believing everything that you're saying, you are nonetheless watching it out of an aesthetic pursuit, I guess. As to whether or not they're winning, I think it's worth keeping in mind that soft power doesn't exist in a vacuum, and one of the key reasons that Western soft power had proven so successful is that it came on the backs of such economic potential and economic growth, both on an individual and a macro level. And one of the reasons that we've seen relative success for Russian soft power in Central Asia because Russia had proven to be the destination for migrant laborers, for one of the largest trade partners in the region. And over the last year, over the last 18 months, that has begun shifting. And I know Kishlakovsky has done a fantastic job of covering the remittances drop-off, you know, over 40% in Tajikistan and Uzbekistan, over 30% in Kyrgyzstan. And the question, at least for me right now, is this soft power or perception of successful soft power going to be able to continue on the backs of such declining remittances and declining trade and declining infrastructural investment? And I think that's something worth watching as we move forward.
Mr. Yenvekov, you said that in a few years ago, Russia failed in advancing its agendas through the soft power in Kyrgyzstan. What the successful tools Kyrgyzstan had that can be applicable in other Central Asian countries to counter the Russian move there?
Regarding soft power, Russia couldn't succeed in Kyrgyzstan. Therefore, they use other tools like, as I mentioned, propaganda, energy pressure, or just bribing of politicians. And for short term, I am absolutely sure that Russia is winning Kyrgyz spirit regarding Russia, because last social survey, today about 80% of our population, they think that Russia is a bit, and Russia is a friendly country for Kyrgyzstan, but Western countries and America is enemy for Kyrgyzstan. It means Russia, for sure, they're winning using their propaganda that they could change people's minds that Russia is a good country. But long term, I'm absolutely because Russia did nothing in Kyrgyzstan regarding soft power, and they are losing on long-term strategy.
You said in short-term Russia is winning in Kyrgyzstan, like you gave examples of some opinion polls there. So is there anything in place on the ground to counter Russian strategy today against its advance, against its victory?
No, I would say strategically, Russia has nothing to win in Kyrgyzstan or they maintain their position. Russia is losing because Russia worked just for short term, and strategically, I wouldn't say that they have something interesting in Kyrgyzstan to attract the Kyrgyz people.
But then why people think positive about Russia then? Why the number of those people who are thinking positive about Russia in Kyrgyzstan is increasing, as you just have said?
Because Russia use their propaganda. Russia has about five television channels, mass media, internet sites, radios. Therefore, they're just changing people's minds. It's propaganda, and it's wrong thinking of our people, our population.
Sure. So what is the effective way to counter this strategy in Kyrgyzstan?
I don't know, but anyway, I know that Russian way to work short-term or long-term or using soft power, it's wrong way, and they're losing.
Yeah, Bradley?
I think one problem, particularly from the Western point of view, is that the West became a bit passive and it sees its entertainment industry almost as a substitute for effective diplomacy. So, I mean, one aspect of this has been, for example, the BBC, Russian service, has had massive decreases in its funding. But since the Ukrainian crisis, demand for the Russian service and the BBC has actually doubled. So clearly the demand's there for these services, but they've been cut. So, I mean, I think the West really needs to invest in expanding its foreign services.
Bruce, what can be done about that? I mean,
there's
are we doing enough? I mean, when I say we, the international community,
you know, of course, I was a student of history, so I tend to look at these things as having ebbs and flows to them. Right now, you know, it's flowing for Russia. That's true, and it comes at the same time. We got to remember, the U.S. and the West, for instance, were heavily engaged in Central Asia more because it was neighboring Afghanistan, and of course, that was a focus of Washington's attention for a while. At the same time that we've been disengaging from Afghanistan, that also has corollary to that is the reduction in funding, in direct funding to Central Asian governments. Manas closed, for instance, in Kyrgyzstan. But generally across the board, there's been reduction in the amount of funds that the U.S. is making available to the Central Asian governments, which of course grew to be huge in the middle part of the last decade and toward the end of the last decade when the U.S. was involved in Afghanistan. So there's there's also that symbolic kind of view to it that, the U.S. and the West, they're kind of fading for the moment from the region. And Russia, all of a sudden, while the West has been disengaging from Central Asia, Russia has seen lately that it has a new competitor in Central Asia. And that, of course, would be China, the economically powerful newcomer to Central Asia. And so, it makes sense that Russia would ramp up its efforts, and it's across a whole spectrum. I mean, Mr. Janbeck, I've mentioned that it was the propaganda, but I would also argue that it has been a lot the soft power, and it's the message. And Casey's done a lot of work with this too, where you start out with a truthful message and then you get into one that, as you do your report, it gets a little more speculative and then ends up being a flat out lie by the end. But there's such a jumble of information in there, it's hard to tell by the end which parts were the truth parts and which parts were the ones that nobody knows for sure and which parts were the ones that are just not true at all. But Russia has ramped that up because they see that there's a threat from China. So, you know, it's across the board. It's everything they can do. It's economic aid when they can, military aid certainly, and they keep banging the war drum about look out, you know, the evil Islamic extremists are coming for you, you know, and you can just put whatever name you want on that. They'll find somebody. Right now it's the Islamic State. But, you know, so they give Kyrgyzstan $1 billion in military aid. They give Tajikistan another $1 billion in military aid. You know, all this stuff it creates this image of who's your friend, who's there to help you, you know, and like I said, it comes at a time when they're competing against China, but also the West is fading. Things will change. And today, for instance, we saw that Gazprom Kyrgyzstan, I can't remember which name they're using now, but just said that they're going to have to raise rates, utility rates. Gas rates are going up, and they're not only going to go up, but they say to ease the impact, every month the rate's going to go up slightly a little bit more. Now, these are things that other media outlets like us can use to say, you know, how much of a friend is Russia, for instance, to you? You know, okay, they came in, they bought your gas company, you sold it for a symbolic $1, you know, and they promised you that you were going to have, you know, as much gas as you could use. There wouldn't be any more cutoffs. There wouldn't be any drastic rate hikes. Okay, there's not a drastic rate hike, but in the meantime, what they're now proposing is a gradual rate hike that's going to be in effect for 4 years. So every month your bill is going to be bigger, you know, and things like that kind of sour the public's image on what Russia looks like. And China is going to make mistakes in the future too, that will also lead to people rethinking the relationship they have and the relationship they should have with China. And, you know, and these are moments when you jump in with your own soft power and point out, you know, that they didn't live up to their promises, and you know, but and maybe you make some new promises, I don't know. But anyway, you gotta look for these, like I said, ebbs and flows. It's gonna go back and forth for a while. Russia's invested a lot of time and effort into it. Like I said, they have a multi-level strategy going into this. And, you know, the West will adapt. Russia's up now, but they won't be for long. China has also got a lot of influence, but we'll see how much interest they want to keep in this region for how long. So, you know, it'll change.
Some of them was also available, Casey, in your article. At this moment, the way the Russian media presents the things that's happening in the region to its audience in Central Asia or another part of the world is completely different the way a responsible journalist would do, like the Radio Free Europe do. So how far we can go to counter that argument? Should we follow in the same line like Russian media has done? Or maybe is there any other way to follow or any strategy to follow in terms of countering Russian, at least the Russian media propaganda in the region?
Yeah, I think one of the most remarkable things about this is that this discussion that we're having right now as it pertains to Russian soft power and Russian media in Central Asia is almost the exact same discussion that people in the States, that people in the EU are having as well, as it pertains to Russian media, most especially as it pertains to RT. Now, if there was an easy answer, it would have been taken by now. Unfortunately, there's not. You know, some people have discussed whether or not they should outright ban RT or other Russian outlets. There have been some people who have said, why don't we start our own Western news organization that does just the exact same amount of spin, the exact same amount of production value as the Russian media, as RT. And I think while both of those have their merits and their arguments for them, I don't think either of those are the right move. I don't think there should be a ban. I don't think there should be new outlets that have the same amount of spin, the same amount of propaganda. I mean, I think one of the foremost things that RCRL has going for it, and other publications as well, is that this is, Mohammed, just as you mentioned, what a responsible journalist does. You check your facts, you check your sources, you check where you're getting your information from, and then you present it in an unbiased manner for the reader or for the listener or for the viewer. And that's one of the things that Russian media certainly does not do, and that is to Russian media's eventual detriment. And you know, Bruce said, yeah, they're winning right now, or it's proving successful right now, but there are ebbs and there are flows. And if we or if media outlets determine that the best course of action is to sink to the level of these Russian media outlets, then they are no different than the Russian media outlets. And what's the point of listening to them in the first place? That's not what's going to win out. It is responsible journalism that's going to win out. And whether that happens over here in the States, whether that happens in Central Asia, you know, for my money, that's the best tack to take. It's to continue with the successful, responsible journalism.
Right. That's a pretty optimistic note, Casey. I think we could end our discussion with that?
No, that's a great way to end it. That's for sure. You know, no, I'm all for that. I think so too. As long as you just keep telling the truth, sooner or later you'll expose the lie.
Okay, gentlemen. Casey Mitchell from New York, Roshan Jinbekov from Kyrgyzstan, Bruce Panier and Bradley Jordan here in the studio. Thank you very much for being part of the discussion. It has been a pleasure talking to you.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. We're looking forward to the next round. And
thank you so much for having me on, as ever.
Thank you, guys.
Yeah.